Thank you, Aaron, and thank you all for coming. So I want to start out by talking a little bit about classical chaotic motion and reminding you of some things about it. So here's a famous problem in classical chaos theory. It's just a particle moving in a two-dimensional potential called the Hennen-Hiles potential. It looks like this. It's basically, we can think of it on a plane, it's an r-squared potential perturbed by an r-cubed term, but with this angular dependence on it. And, of course, the r-cubed means if you go too far away from the origin, you'll fall down one of these chutes. But if you're near the origin, you can just rattle around here. And then you can do things like follow the orbit of a particle in this potential. Here's one particular very complicated orbit, and one way to make it less complicated is to look at what's called the Poincaré section. So I'm going to look at values of the y-coordinate and the time derivative of the y-coordinate when the x-coordinate happens to be zero. And for a particular orbit, you get this nice simple figure over here. That's at a fairly low energy. If you go to a somewhat higher energy, you get a much more complicated looking orbit. So this is now, you can see we now are tracing, this is actually several orbits at the same energy. Some of them are simple, like these little circles, but others are quite complicated and go in these more complex paths. This particular old-fashioned looking figure is actually taken from a review article by Hennen, which was written in the 80s. And if we go to still higher energies, we get even more complex behavior. Now we see some relatively simple figures. And again, each of these figures is one particular orbit. But then you see these scattered dots. And these scattered dots are also one particular orbit, but now one that's much more complicated. So on these orbits, we can say the particle is executing regular motion, but over here, it's executing something we could call chaotic motion. And if we go to still higher energies, we now get less and less regular motion and more chaotic motion. So this seems to be a general feature of classical Hamiltonian mechanics. If you just write down a random Hamiltonian on a piece of paper that you make up, and ask what is its behavior, it's very likely that you will have regular behavior in some regions of phase space, but chaotic behavior in other regions of phase space. And many systems have mostly chaotic behavior, and some systems have only chaotic behavior. So a nice simple class of systems to study are billiard systems, where we just have a particle bouncing around inside some shape. So here are three billiards that lead to regular or integrable motion. A square, a rectangle would also work, an ellipse or a circle. And the red lines are showing, again, the path of a particular particle bouncing around inside. But other shapes lead to chaotic motion. So here's a circular barrier inside a square. This is called the Sinai billiard. This is two semicircular segments separated by straight segments. That's called the stadium billiard, and then the cardioid billiard. And a characteristic feature of these three is that motion inside any one of these is always chaotic. And again, the graphs, which were produced by Arne Backer in Germany, show the path, one particular path, and you can easily visually see the difference between the paths in the chaotic billiards and the paths in the integrable billiards. Okay, that's all classical mechanics, but one thing we've discovered about the world in the last 100 years is that classical mechanics is actually wrong, and that the world is quantum mechanical. So if we were to treat these systems quantum mechanically, what should we do? Well, because you've all taken the class in quantum mechanics, you know what you generally do when you're given a quantum mechanics problem. somebody hands you a Hamiltonian, the first thing you try to do, if you can, is find its eigenvalues and eigenstates. And that's a really good thing to do, because if you've found the eigenvalues and eigenstates, then you've also, in principle, solved all time-dependent problems. Here, I guess I should specify I'm considering only time-independent Hamiltonians. We can, of course, consider time-dependent Hamiltonians with external forces, but I don't want to do that. So I have a time-independent Hamiltonian. I find its eigenvalues and eigenstates. And then I can express the state at time t, which I'm writing as a subscript here, psi sub t, as just a superposition of eigenstates. The eigenstates are labeled with an alpha. I have some superposition coefficient c sub alpha. And then I have to stick in a time-dependent phase, which is this e to the minus I, the energy, e sub alpha times time. And boom, we've solved all time-dependent problems at once. So that's a really nice thing to do. Here's something to think about. Why don't we do classical mechanics this way? There's actually a really interesting answer to that, which I'm not going to tell you right now. Okay, so that's how you do quantum mechanics. And in classical mechanics, in my pictures, I was trying to show that there are easily identifiable differences between integrable or regular motion and chaotic motion in a classical mechanical system. Suppose you took one of those classical mechanical systems and quantized it, treated it via quantum mechanics instead of classical mechanics. Would you be able to tell, just doing the quantum mechanics, if that the system is, you know, can you detect chaos in the classical system by looking at intrinsically quantum mechanical things? And the answer is yes. And there are some somewhat surprising things that you might not have guessed. One of the simplest things you can look at is the statistics of energy eigenvalues. So you have a Hamiltonian, and we're going to solve the energy eigenvalue problem. I'm always going to assume that my systems of interest are bounded in space. I don't want to think about infinitely big systems. And if the system is bounded in space, then its energy eigenvalues are always discrete. So you have a discrete series of energy eigenvalues. And you could ask questions like, if I have a level here, how likely am I to find another level a certain distance in energy away? How far in energy do I have to go before I encounter another level? So if we have a lot of levels, we can treat that as a statistical problem and think of that as a probability. Ask, given a level, what is the probability that if I go a distance s up in energy or down, I would find another level? And it turns out the answer to this question is different for chaotic systems and integrable systems. In integrable systems, you almost always find that the probability of a spacing goes like e to the minus s. Now, of course, really there's some scale in here. Here I normalize the spacing to the mean level spacing. So this is really more of a schematic formula. But what does this tell us? What this really tells us is that the levels don't care about each other. If I have a level at a particular point and I want to know how likely am I to encounter another one, the answer is it doesn't care. That this is like exponential decay in time. If you have a constant probability per unit time for something to decay, the probability that it has not decayed by time t goes like 1 minus e to the minus t. So this is the same effect. The e to the minus t is just that if you haven't hit a level and haven't hit a level and haven't hit a level, the probability that you haven't hit one goes down exponentially. But what it really means is the levels just don't care about each other. In a chaotic system, you tend to get a very different answer. You get something that looks like this. There's an exponent here, beta, which is either 1, 2, or 4. Which depends on the symmetry properties of the system. Most commonly, you get beta equals 1. This is for systems that are time reversal invariant. Beta equals 2 you get for systems which are not time reversal invariant, which is less common in nature. And 4 involves some sort of spin symmetry that I'm not going to talk about at all. But In particular, you can see that at small s, small spacings, the probability is suppressed. And this is a phenomenon you've seen before. This is level repulsion. You may know that if you do something like put an atom in a magnetic field and vary the magnetic field, the levels will change, and two levels may come close to each other. And if the levels are distinguished by some quantum number, like angular momentum, then they might cross. But if they're not distinguished by such a quantum number, they don't cross. They repel each other. And that's because they start interacting with each other, and there's an interaction matrix element between the two levels, and that always produces a spacing. In a chaotic system, there aren't supposed to be any conserved quantities at all, and so all levels repel all the time, and so we get this S to some power suppression. And this particular distribution was discovered a long time ago by very famous people, Wigner and Dyson. It's called the Wigner-Dyson distribution. And they discovered it not by studying any particular classical system, but by looking at eigenvalues of random matrices. They were interested in nuclear physics, and nuclear physics is very complicated. A nucleus is a very complicated thing. It's hard to even write down the Hamiltonian. So they said, it's so complicated, let's write down a random Hamiltonian. Seems very weird. This started the subject of random matrix theory, where you think of your Hamiltonian as a random matrix where you just pick each matrix element from a Gaussian distribution and then ask for the properties of the eigenvalues of those matrices. And this is the spacing distribution you get. And again, the exponent depends on the symmetries of the matrix. These are called the Gaussian orthogonal ensemble for matrices that are diagonalizable by an orthogonal transformation, the unitary ensemble for matrices that are diagonalizable by a unitary transformation, and the symplectic ensemble, etc. Okay, so those are the three ensembles of random matrices studied by Wigner and Dyson. What was learned in the 80s is that these distributions also apply to eigenvalues of chaotic systems. So let me show you a quick example. This is my favorite example. A ball bouncing on a tilted floor. So, of course, you should really think of it as a point particle, not a ball. But so there's a gravity, and the ball bounces, and it reflects off the floor or reflects off the wall. And my floor is tilted at an angle alpha. And it turns out that classically, the motion is integrable if the angle of tilt is less than or equal to 45 degrees, and chaotic if the angle of tilt is greater than 45 degrees, which is kind of strange, but also kind of cool. And these guys, Soretti and Goodings, 20 years ago, studied the quantum mechanics of this problem. And this is what they found. They studied the energy eigenvalues of the quantum problem and looked at the level spacings and looked at the spacing distributions. And for a 45-degree floor, 45-degree tilt of the floor, they get a perfect Poisson distribution, the e to the minus s. And for a 49-degree tilt, which is in the chaotic region, they get a very nice Wigner-Dyson distribution with beta equals 1. And there's all kinds of examples of this now known, and except in certain special cases which have various features that are not generic, this is what you always find. And coming back to the Wigner-Dyson problem of nuclei, this also works in nuclei. This is again an old transparency. I don't know if there's an updated version of this now or not, but this is called the nuclear data ensemble. And looking at a bunch of different nuclei with energy levels measured by a neutron scattering, you could determine energy levels in various nuclei. You could then normalize them properly and combine them into one big distribution. And that's this histogram. And again, it's here we're comparing it to the Poisson distribution versus the Gaussian orthogonal distribution. And you can see the Gaussian orthogonal distribution fits very well. So, of course, a nucleus doesn't really have a classical limit, so it's not classical chaos that's producing this phenomenon here, but a different kind of complexity But what the general result is that complexity in your quantum problem tends to lead to statistical results the system is acting as if its Hamiltonian was a random matrix, which is, I think, very cool. There's some more things you can say. There's a nice thing you can say about eigenfunctions. Let me concentrate on a billiard system where, again, I just have a ball bouncing or a particle bouncing inside some fixed walls. Because it's just a free particle except for reflecting off the walls, a plane wave would be a solution if I didn't worry about the boundary condition. And the magnitude of the wave vector is fixed by the energy, and so that has to have a definite magnitude, but it could point in any direction. So you could imagine trying to build up a wave function by superposing plane waves with some coefficients that I'm calling A sub j here. So imagine I took n different values for the direction of the wave vector, which say go around a circle. I'm doing this all in two dimensions. Go around a circle in two dimensions, so they have fixed length but different angle. I superpose them with coefficients, and then I try to adjust the coefficients so that the wave function itself vanishes at the wall. So a long time ago, in 1977, Michael Berry conjectured that if you did that and you expressed the wave function this way, and then you just looked at these coefficients, these a sub j's, they would look like Gaussian random variables. And this turns out to be true. So here are a couple of pictures. Here's a superposition of random waves. And here's an actual eigenfunction in the cardioid billiard. Now, because this cardioid billiard has a symmetry across the horizontal axis, so the wave function also has a symmetry, so it's just reflected here and here. So you should really just look at, say, the top half. But if you look at the top half of this, you can see it looks quite a bit like this, just pictorially. Now, of course, there are all sorts of statistical tests you can do, too, and I'm not going to show you the statistical tests, but these eigenfunctions that you produce with great computer, it takes a lot of computer effort to actually calculate this thing, these eigenfunctions pass all sorts of tests for being Gaussian random functions in the sense on the previous transparency. Here's a nice it's looking funny on my screen. Looks better up here. I was asked to provide an image for my colloquium, so there are posters around here, I guess, with this picture on it. This picture was made by Eric Heller at Harvard. He was a pioneer in the early study of chaotic eigenfunctions. And he has a website where he has I didn't mean to press that button yet. He has a website where he has a bunch of beautiful pictures, not only of this one is of random waves on a sphere, but he also has lots of nice pictures of other physical effects that he's been involved with. I recommend you Google his name and find his website. Lots of cool pictures. But this is just random waves on a sphere, and again, showing the generic structure of what chaotic eigenfunctions look like. Okay. So far I've given a lightning review of classical chaos and a lightning review of quantum chaos, and now I want to turn to the problem of statistical mechanics and how and why it works. So way back in the 90s, I was asked to teach our graduate statistical mechanics course at Santa Barbara, which I'd never taught before. And I thought, okay, that'll be fun. And then I started thinking about the sorts of classic problems of statistical mechanics. So here are a bunch of atoms. There's some sort of gas. They have some short-range interactions. But I put them all in the lower left corner of the box moving up. And later, I expect, because I took that class in statistical mechanics while ago. I expect that they'll be distributed throughout the box with a thermal distribution of momentum. But if I actually wanted to show that, how would I do it? And so I was thinking about teaching this class, and I thought, well, you know, it would be really interesting to show how you do this without statistical mechanics, and that would be long and hard, and then how much easier it is if you know statistical mechanics. But then it slowly began to realize that I didn't actually know how you would show this without statistical mechanics. And I had some vague idea how you would do it if the system was classical. If it was classical, then there'd be some, it would be ergodic, and there would be some sort of ergodicity would somehow tell me that it had to do, I didn't really understand how this worked either, but I had this vague idea that you could do it in classical mechanics, but I really had no idea whatsoever how you would do it if you were doing quantum mechanics. If I thought of this state, if I thought of this picture as being described by a wave function, and then I was going to time evolve the wave function with the Schrodinger equation and get to this, I didn't know how to do that. So my first thought was, I must have skipped class the day they explained this. So I went to the library and started reading books on statistical mechanics, and I discovered they were filled with complete nonsense. That's a little too strong, but all sorts of hand-waving arguments. So the books would have wild hand-waving, and then you'd get to the standard formula of statistical mechanics, and then everything would be okay, because after that you'd solve some standard problems. But the hand-waving part, if you really sat down and read it carefully, it really did not make any sense, at least to me. So this really bothered me. I thought, this is a 100-year-old problem. Someone has to have figured this out and written it down. So I tried to think about how this could possibly work. And I want to think about it quantum mechanically. So here's how I want to think about it. Suppose I have some observable that I'm going to call capital A, and here I've written an little a dagger, little a sub p. The notion here is that this is counting the number of particles with some momentum p. It doesn't really matter what this observable is very much, but I want to have in the back of my mind, let's count particles with momentum p. And so in the previous picture, if p is up, lots of particles have momentum p, and then later not so many do because they all have all different momenta. So, and in quantum mechanics, one thing you can compute is expectation values. So I imagine we start with an initial state where this observable a is very far from its equilibrium value. And so here I've computed an equilibrium value from the formula later in the book after they've told you what it is. And what do we expect to happen? Well, we started out far from equilibrium, but because we all took that class, or just because we have experience with the real world, we expect that this expectation value will come down and come down to its thermal equilibrium value, and then stay there most of the time. And I've drawn this as a wiggly line because there are fluctuations. It's not going to do this exactly. It'll fluctuate. And maybe later there'll be a rare large fluctuation where it comes back up. But we expect it to move down to this thermal value and then stay there most of the time. Okay, so that's what we expect because we took the class in statistical mechanics. But we also took the class in quantum mechanics, so we know how to compute it. So let's compute it. Here's my time-dependent expectation value. Here's my state using that formula. I've set h bar to 1 now because I got tired of typing the h bars. And here's the expectation value. I just plug it in and I get a double sum. And now we can compute the long time average. So this is the instantaneous expectation value. I can average it over time. And if you average it over time, what's going to happen? Well, these phases will all average out to zero if alpha is different than beta, and if all the energy eigenvalues are different. So let me assume there's no degeneracy in the system at all. So all my energy eigenvalues are different, then all the off-diagonal phases will go away if I take a very long time average, and I'll end up with just the diagonal terms here, where this A sub alpha beta, I hope the notation is obvious, it means the matrix element of the operator between two energy eigenstates. And so here's the first problem. The problem is this is supposed to be equal to the thermal average, because if I take the long time average and it's at its thermal value most of the time, the long time average should be equal to the thermal average. But the thermal average doesn't depend on anything. It's only got one parameter in it, the temperature, whereas this guy seems to depend very sensitively on these C alphas. The C alphas specify the initial state. I get to pick the initial state. I can pick any initial state I want. So how is it that this long time average doesn't depend on these C alphas? That's the first problem. And so I got that far on my own, but then I was kind of stuck. I didn't know what to do. But because I had this vague intuition that chaos theory had something to do with classical statistical mechanics, and because I'd heard of something called quantum chaos theory, I thought maybe quantum chaos theory had something to say about this. So I went to the library and got books on quantum chaos theory, and in those books I found something called Schnirelmann's theorem. Schnirelmann's theorem says that if you have an observable, and it's a nice classical observable, and in particular, when you write it down, it doesn't have any h-bars in it, and you take its expectation value in an energy eigenstate, and the energy is high enough, this expectation value in an energy eigenstate, the value of it will be the same as the classical microcanonical average of this observable A in a chaotic system. And that's exactly what we need, because this says it doesn't actually depend on the detail, any detailed properties of the state. All you have to know is the energy of the state. And the energy is basically the same as the temperature, in a way I'll get to more precisely in a minute. So this matrix element only depends on the energy, not the details. So if I change the matrix, if I change the energy a little bit, this matrix element won't change much. And actually, this is even much stronger statement than we need. We actually need a much weaker statement, which is that this matrix element is a number of order 1. That is, it doesn't depend on h-bar. Well, I want to say it doesn't depend on h-bar. It starts out as it's a number that's not large or small when h-bar gets large or small, and that it varies smoothly with the energy. And this part actually... I'm not going to show this because it takes a while, but you can show that this also follows from the random wave conjecture for the eigenfunctions. If you think of those eigenfunctions as being composed of random waves, you can derive this statement from that. It basically says that when you take a matrix element, all the randomness in the random waves cancels out, and only the gross classical features of it survive. Anyway, let's see how that works. So Schnirelmann's theorem, or the random wave conjecture, tell me that if I were to plot my A alphas alphas versus energy, they should not change much as I vary the energy. So they should lie on some sort of smooth curve, maybe with a little bit of jitter, but not very much. So they should not change much as I vary the energy. My C alpha squareds, on the other hand, those can jump all over the place. I get to pick those. But I am going to assume that my quantum energy uncertainty, called delta E here, the quantum energy uncertainty is given by the spread in the C alphas. I'm going to assume that's not too big. Now it's easy to see what happens. Because within this range delta E, all the A alpha alphas are essentially the same. So it doesn't matter how I weight them within that range. I'm going to get this number out. And that's the answer. If the quantum energy uncertainty is sufficiently small in some way, which we don't have to specify too precisely, then because these A alpha alphas are all the same within that range, this long time average is independent of the C alphas. And then it's a very short step to show that it has to be the thermal average, because if it's independent of the C alphas, I can let the C alphas be Boltzmann weights. And if they're Boltzmann weights, then I'm just doing exactly the thermal calculation. So, and in, also if they're Boltzmann weights, the energy uncertainty is indeed algebraically small in n, the number of particles. It goes like 1 over root n times the energy. And then the A bar has to just be the thermal average, up to small corrections. All right, so I keep saying the same thing. So this is something I called eigenstate thermalization back in 1994. It turned out there had been a paper written by Josh Deutsch of Santa Cruz a few years earlier in which he came to the same conclusion based on an analogy with random matrix theory. But the idea is that in a sufficiently complicated system, and the example is a classically chaotic system, that the energy eigenstates in that system look thermal if you look at them with observables that are reasonable. And in the classical case, it means an observable that has a nice classical limit. If you're allowed to make up any observable you want, if you can make up your observable by writing down its matrix in the energy basis, then you can certainly find things that don't look thermal. But if you use nice observables that make physical sense, and you only look at your state by measuring those observables, an individual energy eigenstate will look thermal. Okay. And this explains why the long time average is independent of the initial state, as long as its quantum uncertainty is not, energy uncertainty is not too big, and equal to the thermal average. Okay. So that's actually half the story. If we write down this expectation value, this is the long time term, but then we have all the other terms. And so we not only want to understand why the long time average is the thermal average, we also want to understand that not it moves to the thermal average and then stays there most of the time. So that means that this term has to be small most of the time. But it turns out that it's also easy to understand from the random wave conjecture. The random wave conjecture implies that these matrix elements will vary erratically with alpha and beta. And if we compute, well, here I've subtracted off its mean value, its expectation value in the state, and squared it, I'm going to get the sum of squares of matrix elements here. And this should come out to be a number of order 1 in terms of counting powers of H bar, because A squared should be a nice observable just like A, and I'm only looking at observables that are order 1 in powers of H bar. But when I do this sum over intermediate states that I inserted here, I'm summing a huge number of states. There's a density of states factor here, and the density of states factor is enormous. It goes like H bar to minus the number of degrees of freedom. But yet this sum is supposed to come out to be of order 1. And there are two ways that can happen. One way is that most of these matrix elements could be 0. That's what happens in integrable systems where there are selection rules. And so the selection rules tell you that matrix elements of interesting observables are often 0. Most of these will be 0, and that's why the sum doesn't come out to be big, even though there's a large density of states factor. That explanation isn't available in the chaotic case because there aren't supposed to be any selection rules in a chaotic system. So these should vary erratically, but most of them should not be 0. But if most of them are not 0, then they must all be very small because they've got the large density of states factor and they have to compensate for that. So here are two ways of writing the estimate, either as a power of H bar or the number of degrees of freedom. If you translate that into a density of states, remember the density of states is the exponential of the entropy. These are suppressed by a factor of e to the minus the entropy over 2 here. Very small, in other words. Okay, but now we're basically done because we see that these A alpha and betas are always very small. If you work very hard to choose your C alphas very carefully, you can get all the very small A alpha betas to line up, and that's what allows you to create an initial state which is far from thermal equilibrium. But once you've done that, time evolution will start turning on these phases. They won't add up coherent. These terms won't add up coherently anymore. This will become generically small again, and you'll move back to thermal equilibrium. At some much later time, it's possible the phases will come into approximate alignment again, and then you could have a spike, a very rare spike of this. But knowing that these guys are smooth functions of the energy, and knowing that these guys are all very small, is what you need to explain, to reconcile this formula from quantum mechanics with this picture from statistical mechanics. So we're done. If we believe the properties of these matrix elements that we get from quantum chaos theory, if we believe that those apply to a system in some particular system we're interested in, then we can understand why that system, even if completely isolated, would come to thermal equilibrium. Okay, so I thought that was very cool, and I wrote papers about it in the 90s, and I was very excited, and nobody paid any attention. It happens. So I went off, and then something happened in 2006. In 2006, some guys at Penn State, David Weiss and his group, wrote a paper that got an enormous amount of attention called A Quantum Newton's Cradle. They were colliding cold atoms in one... They had a laser trap that allowed them to collide gases of cold atoms in one dimension. They had two pulses that came in, and what they expected is the two pulses would come in, they would form a single cloud of atoms, that cloud would thermalize and then sit there. But that's not what happened. Didn't mean to do that quite yet. Instead, the clouds passed through each other and kept oscillating back and forth. And actually, this is really not very hard to understand, and in fact, they explained it themselves in their paper. In one dimension, if you just have point-like interactions, you can't have non-trivial changes of momentum. The particles just bounce off, but they don't change the value of their momenta. So whatever momentum distribution you have, you just keep the same momentum distribution. It's like this famous toy where things hit each other and bounce back. Okay, and here are some nice pictures from their experiment showing the clouds colliding and separating again. And this is a graph of something about that, which I don't remember what it is exactly. I'm a theorist. Okay. Well, then some guys at USC, Marcus Riegel, Vaja Junko, and Maxime Olshani were thinking about this theoretically, and they were trying to do some theoretical investigations. They studied some simple model problems where they had what are called hardcore bosons on lattice sites. Hardcore bosons are bosons, but you're not allowed to put more than one of them on a lattice site. And they would do things like take a lattice that looked like this and populate these states and then open up a gate here and allow them to hop and watch what happened. And this is effectively a chaotic system. It doesn't have a classical limit, but it's got the sort of complexity that we expect to lead to the sorts of statistical chaotic behaviors like the Wigner-Dyson energy distributions. And what they saw, this is some particular observable. This is the number of particles with a certain momentum. The jagged blue line is the actual numerical experiment. And then they have both a microcanonical and a canonical distribution here, and they have what they call the diagonal ensemble, which means throw out all those oscillating terms in the quantum expression for the expectation value and keep only the diagonal term. And here they see that basically the diagonal, the microcanonical, and the canonical all agree. There's some slight differences because they really didn't have enough particles to really be too deeply into the thermodynamic limit. Here's again a comparison now of the diagonal or microcanonical ensemble, which basically gave the same result, and two different individual eigenstates. This is again verifying this property that I called eigenstate thermalization, individual energy eigenstates, when you look at them by looking at the values of particular the observables that are nice and make sense physically, that those observables look like they're in thermal equilibrium in a given energy eigenstate. So they verified that in this case. They also studied integrable chains. Here they just have a linear chain, and this is an integrable system which is not expected to have this behavior, and now all the graphs disagree with each other. They don't see this. So this theoretical paper got a lot of attention, and they did know about my work, and they referenced it, which was nice of them, and suddenly attention was being paid to it. And so this has now become an interesting topic again, and at the Kavli Institute in Santa Barbara, there have been we just completed a three-month workshop on quantum dynamics of out-of-equilibrium systems. There was an earlier workshop on cold atoms last year where these ideas were prominent again. So the moral is all the theory in the world isn't worth as much as one good experiment, because people actually pay attention to experiments, which is a good thing. Okay, so I'm really at the end of most of what I wanted to tell you. So the main point is that ideas from quantum chaos theory lead very quickly to the notion of eigenstate thermalization, that if you have a sufficiently complicated system, its individual energy eigenstates look thermal if you look at them with observables that make physical sense. And if that's true, it's just a few lines to show that you should expect the validity of statistical mechanics for such a system. That said, there are many open problems. So I've been talking about a dichotomy between chaotic systems and integrable systems. Actually, of course, those are two extremes on a continuum. What happens to a near integrable system? This is a subject of much interest and debate. Various interesting phenomena seem to happen in such systems, such as pre-thermalization, where observables will move to some plateau that's related to the integrable system that the near-integrable system is near, but then much later act as if the system was chaotic. And this behavior is not yet understood. Lots of stuff to try to understand. How the eigenstate thermalization idea, it certainly can't be true at arbitrarily low energies. The ground state, for example, is a very special state. It doesn't have this random wave structure. How high in energy do you have to go before you transition from something with a lot of structure like the ground state to something that looks like random waves? That's not well understood. Finally, not everyone thinks this is the right theory of thermalization. They're wrong, but what are the alternatives, and how do they work, and are they really viable? Really, the picture is so general that if you're really going to talk about an isolated system, really the only alternative is that certain classes of initial states will come to thermal equilibrium, even if the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis is not true. But what are those classes of initial states that can come to equilibrium? Are they a broad class? Are they a small class? That's an interesting question, which very little is known about. So I'm going to stop there. Thank you.